From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You know it when a speaker has the audience in the palm of her hand. It's like they don't budge, they're hanging on every word, you can hear a pin drop. But of course, you can also tell when a speech is just not working. The crowd gets restless, people start looking at their watches and their phones. The linguist David Kristol has been examining exactly what was going on when the speech worked and also when it was going bust. And he's written a book about eloquence. In it, he writes about the elements of it. It's fluent, he says, and personal and appropriate and clear, and it takes work. But in the end, Kristol says it's all about delivery. No amount of preparation will make up for a bad performance. Today in the program, David Kristol will join us to explain the gift of gab. Join us after the news.
Purchase the books that you hear featured on Radio West by clicking the IndieBound, Amazon, or Audible links included with each show at RadioWest.org. A portion of proceeds from these affiliate partners supports Radio West. While you're there, you can check out all the show archives. Thanks for listening.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When was the last time you heard real eloquence? Maybe it was a speech, though that's not the only setting where you'll find it, of course. You can hear it in good stories and good conversation. And by the way, do you hear eloquence as much these days as you may have in the past? Maybe that's something we can talk about today with David Kristol. He's a linguist who's written a book about eloquence. And one of the things Kristol says in the book is that anyone with normal language skills has the gift of gab. In fact, he says we're all wired for eloquence. But it takes work, of course, preparation and practice. Kristol does say the first step, though, is to understand how eloquence works. So that's what we're doing today. We're talking about how eloquence works. The book is called The Gift of Gab, and we invite you to join us. You may have questions or comments. How do you think eloquence works? What are some of the speeches or stories you've heard in your life that were powerful or inspiring? And are we still as eloquent as we may have been in the past? 801-585-WEST is the number. 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. David Kristol is an independent scholar with lifelong experience as a lecturer, as a public speaker, a broadcaster. He's the author of more than 100 books on phonetics, Shakespeare's language, children's language, other topics. His latest book, as I mentioned, is The Gift of Gab, How Eloquence Works. And he's joining us today from his home studio in Holyhead, Wales. And David Kristol, welcome to you.
Well, Doug, it's nice to be with you. Hello.
Hi. Well, I guess I wanted to begin with your own interest in the subject. You've described your relationship with eloquence as a love affair. Let's start there. When did you start thinking about the idea of eloquence?
Yes, well, you're quite right. I'm talking to you from Wales. And, of course, that means I'm on the Celtic fringe of the British Isles. And my family background is Irish on my mother's side and Welsh on my father's side. And when you go around in Wales and in Ireland, what you hear is just the gift of the gab all the time. You know, I mean, people talk about the Blarney Stone down in Blarney Castle, you know, where you go and if you kiss it, then you're supposed to be really eloquent. Well, most Irish don't go because they're eloquent already. So that's how it started, you know. When I was a little kid, I remember distinctly just listening to these older relatives, my uncles and my aunts, just jabbering away and telling stories. And I guess a lot of listeners will have exactly the same sort of experience. That's where it starts.
But isn't that one of the important themes in the book, is that you don't have to be a great orator or a great world leader to have a kind of eloquence?
That's exactly right, Doug. Yeah, I mean, my main theme in the book is everybody is naturally eloquent. It's just part of the human condition, you know, homo eloquens, to be eloquent. Now, the thing is that an awful lot of people think they're not, you see, and they'll put forward all kinds of arguments to say, oh, I'm not a very good speaker. Oh, I've got a terrible voice. Oh, people won't like my accent. Oh, I've got nothing to say, and so on. Now, they may believe this, but the evidence that I found when I've talked to people who say this sort of thing to me is I just chat to them for a bit and say, give them a question like, you know, did you watch the television last night? And they say, yeah. What was the program you liked? And they say, I watched this or that. And I say, tell me about it, because I didn't see it. And then they give me the most fantastically eloquent summary of the program that you could hear from anybody, you know. It's just wonderful. And I say, listen, you've just been very, very eloquent. And they look at me as if I'm from a different planet.
So what's the difference then between somebody who can be eloquent on command and someone who just in a natural sort of conversation? Is it about the practice and the delivery? I mean, those are two important parts of the book too.
Yeah, I think it's the difference is essentially one of confidence and confidence building and nerves. You see, these guys I was talking about a few seconds ago, they were just talking to me, so talking to one person, then talking to two people maybe in a conversation or three. Well, they can do it there, but when you say to them, could you talk to 10 or 20 or 50 or 100 people or 1,000, then they say, oh, no. And this is not because they're linguistically unable to do it, you see, it's because they just don't have the confidence to stand up in front of a crowd of people, and they get nervous and all that sort of thing. So this isn't a linguistic problem. It's a problem of developing your experience of talking to large groups.
It's interesting. You say you tell the story of this. I think it's a young girl who tells this story, and you mention how children can be naturally eloquent. And it seems as though I'm wondering if you think that kind of natural ability in a lot of us gets stripped out along the way in school and maybe in church or, you know, at home.
Yeah, something happens, doesn't it, really? I mean, every parent out there will remember the time when, after their child has started to learn to talk, and that was an interesting period, and then suddenly they don't stop talking. they just go on and on and on and on. And then the example I use in the book is from my little kid, actually, from Susie, when she was about 5. Right. And she simply retold the story of the 3 little pigs. I said, tell me the story. And she just went on and on and on, told this wonderful story in which, you know, some of the favorite lines were in there, like I'll huff and I'll puff, and she said that. But then she kind of elaborated on it in a kind of personal sort of way. She went on for about 5 minutes without any interruptions, and it was the most wonderful piece of eloquence. Now, I've heard that from lots and lots of little kiddies of that kind. And then they go to school. Now, it depends on the school, of course. Over in this country, I don't know what it's like in the States, but over here, there are really 2 kinds of schools. There's one type where the teachers and everybody kind of welcomes the kids to talk in class, and they have lots of dialogue and interaction. And then there's another kind of school where it seems, certainly some years ago, maybe there's still a fair number around, where you shut up when you go into the class. You know, you just sit there, and you don't talk until you're spoken to. And that kind of thing, I think, must inevitably diminish that impulse to eloquence that the kiddies have got. I can't explain it otherwise, because certainly by the time you get to teenage years, an awful lot of kids have this, you know, almost adult feeling that they're not very eloquent, really.
I want to ask you about, it's interesting, you tell the story in the book of when you were in, sort of how you got to be a good speaker, a good lecturer. You mentioned that you began by hearing stories in secondary school. When this teacher, you said, showed you how to stretch your voice, and then you end up developing a style of your own. But it's that stretching of your voice that really interested me, because you actually explored the idea of intonation at school.
Yes, intonation, an absolutely crucial part of the whole business. I mean, all the prosody of the voice, all the tone of voice, all the melody of the voice has to be considered. And that means pitch, intonation, the loudness at which you speak, the speed at which you speak, the rhythm that you use when you speak, the silences that you put in. All of these factors have to be there. But the most important one is intonation, the melody of the voice. And the reason for this is that there are more variations in it than any of these other things. I mean, think about loudness, Doug, for a second. I mean, what can you do with loudness? Get louder, get quieter. It's more or less it, isn't it? You know, with crescendo and diminuendo, but there isn't very much you can do. Speed, you can get faster, you can get slower, and that's about it. But with intonation, you've got all this pitch range which can be implemented in a hundreds of different ways. And so when I was sitting there in the classroom, this was in Liverpool now, you see, I was brought up in Wales, yeah, and we moved to Liverpool when I was 10. And so suddenly this Welsh kind of instinct for fluency met up with this Liverpudlian, strong, slangy, down-to-earth, jocular way of talking that the people in Liverpool have.
Yeah.
And it was a very regional accent, you see. And it was very, very almost restricted in its range. Then we go to school, and up comes the elocution teacher. And all she did was simply read to us poetry, folk songs, and so on, in the most gorgeous... I think we all fell in love with her, really, to be honest. And then she made us do it.
Yeah.
And we copied her, and you suddenly... It was almost like a switch releasing in your throat. I suddenly realized that I was only using previously the lower third of my voice range. And the top two thirds were just waiting, waving at me and saying, come and join in.
It's interesting. There seems like there are two parts to this. There are the kind of the rules, which we'll talk about, or at least the suggestions, the things that you've noticed over the years of studying all of this. And then it seems like there's the part that you just kind of gather by listening, the kind of osmosis part, when you hear a great speech or when you're exposed, as you were, by your teacher to songs and stories and those kinds of things that you sort of naturally take to, whether you can maybe explicitly explain what they're about or not. It seems like they just become part of you by listening. Do you think that's part of it?
Yeah, I think absolutely right. And there are some very famous examples of people, of eloquent speakers who have said exactly this. I mean, the one I mention in the book is just one of many, Winston Churchill.
Right.
I mean, Churchill said that he learned to be eloquent, first of all, by listening, listening, listening. He would go to the House of Commons in London and just listen to the people speaking. He would read the speeches of the past that are recorded, and he would say them to himself. And just getting this awareness of what makes a good speech is part of the groundwork, part of the basic learning curve that anybody who wants to be truly eloquent and to use all the tricks of the trade that the great speakers do, that's the place to start. And then what helps you is if you actually intellectually do know what some of these tricks of the trade are. And that's why I wrote the book, really, because yeah, when I would talk to eloquent people, they'd say, well, I know I'm eloquent, but I don't know how I do it. And I'd say, well, have you noticed that you do this or that or the other? And they'd say, oh, yeah. And so it is this balance between instinctive learning from listening and then some intellectual analysis, if you like, that helps people understand what it is that they do.
Winston Churchill is such a perfect example of all of this, because everyone... I guess probably a lot of us imagine that he was born eloquent. But as you just said, he put a lot of work into this. It's interesting. He wrote this essay, you say, when he was, I think he was 22 years old, about rhetoric, the scaffolding of rhetoric. So he's really thinking about how it works. And he had a bit of a lisp. He wasn't exactly the perfect model in some ways, but he became quite great at it. And I guess in many ways it was about the effort that he put into it.
I think that's right. I mean, if there are two words that summarize the state of mind that you have to be in when you want to say something in an eloquent way, they are preparation and rehearsal.
Yeah.
And preparation is everything. I mean, in the book, I've got some lovely quotes. I'm remembering one from Oscar Wilde, who says, you remember reading it, Doug? Spontaneity is a meticulously prepared art.
Yeah.
There's
a great Mark Twain one, too, which is sort of along the same line. The idea that being impromptu, you have to really work at being impromptu.
That's right. He said that he worked at his impromptu speeches and got them off by heart. And then when he was giving a speech, he pretended that they were spontaneous. But all that preparation that goes into it. Yeah, this is the critical thing. Preparation at all costs. And not just for the... for the content of the speech, but although it's partly that, you know, the thing that annoys people more than anything else about somebody who gets up to stand in front of them and speak, whether it's, you know, an after-dinner speech to a club or a wedding breakfast speech or a political speech or a lecture or anything is if you don't keep to time.
Yeah.
You know, as you were saying at the beginning of the hour, you know, when people start looking at their watches and starting to shift about in their chairs, something has gone horribly wrong. And no matter how good your delivery is at that point, if you're not keeping to time, then people switch off. And so this is what I mean by preparation and rehearsal, that you don't just work out what you're going to say and how you're going to say it. You actually make sure that your speech, however length it is, fits into the time frame that makes your listeners most comfortable.
It gets us to something that I liked in the book, this section about the idea of length, just knowing what was appropriate. And you mentioned, which might be, at least in this country, the most famous, one of the most famous speeches is one of the shortest, the Gettysburg Address by Abraham Lincoln. It was just a few minutes long. And I think the context, and you write about this in the book, is that it came after another speech, which was apparently pretty eloquent, but that lasted 2 hours. Talk about the Gettysburg Address in terms of an example of something that can work within the right length.
Yeah, absolutely. A 272-word speech in just 2 minutes, more or less. And complimented afterwards, of course, by Senator Everett, who was the previous orator, who had gone on and on and on and on. And then Lincoln stands up and does this amazing thing. And Everett says at some point, you know, I'd be glad if I could have said everything I said in 2 hours in your 2 minutes, yeah. Which is a lovely compliment to him. But yes, you don't have to speak at length in order to get your point across. That's what the Lincoln speech actually shows us loud and clear. On the other hand, if you've got the time and you've got the content and you've got the motivation, then a speech of 5 or 10, or, you know, in cases like Martin Luther King and Obama and all the others, it can go on longer, and people will drink in everything you're saying because they want to be there and they want to hear what you've got to say. So you don't shortchange them, you know, in that sense.
Dr. King's speech, you point out, was 17 minutes. Winston Churchill's finest hour speech, that came in at 36 minutes. So the length is less important than the content. I wanted to actually play a bit.
Oh, lovely.
From the end of, from the finest hour speech, Winston Churchill's speech. Would you talk a little bit about this speech? Because we want to, I want people to get a sense of the intonation and the way he really brings this moment home, Winston Churchill.
Well, Churchill used to prepare his speeches by, writing, some of them are spontaneous, but a lot of them are written down. And when you actually look at the way he writes them down, it's almost like looking at a poem, you know. Yeah. The lines are sort of short. He builds them up into rhythm units, and he knows where the pauses are going to be. And he talks at a very regular kind of pace. He's not overloading you with lots of facts in a hurry, you know, like some speakers try to do. And the overall effect is of somebody who is almost using prose as if it were poetry.
Here's Winston Churchill.
What General Vagon has called the Battle of France is over. The Battle of Britain is about to begin. Upon this battle depends the survival of Christian civilization. Upon it depends our own British life and the long continuity of our institutions and our empire. The whole fury and might of the enemy must very soon be turned on us. Hitler knows that he will have to break us in this island or lose the war. If we can stand up to him, all Europe may be freed, and the life of the world may move forward into broad, sunlit uplands. But if we fail, then the whole world, including the United States, including all that we have known and cared for, will sink into the abyss of a new dark age, made more sinister and perhaps more protracted by the lights of perverted science. Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty, and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its commonwealths last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.
Great stuff,
Doug. Isn't it?
Oh, and each of these, everybody noticed the short sentences.
Yeah.
That's the thing, or the short chunks of sentences. Churchill seemed to have an instinct for knowing how much the human brain is capable of taking in at a time without it being overloaded. And most of these things are sentences or parts of sentences with 4 beats in or 5 beats in, but rarely longer than that. Clever stuff.
One of the things that the broad sunlit uplands was something that sort of comes to really stood out for me, in the sense that it has such an aesthetic quality. You almost think it wouldn't fit in a speech like that, but the way he mixes them, and then we'll get to triples later, because this is a really fascinating point that we'll come to, but broad sunlit uplands, I'm not sure if that necessarily constitutes a triple, but it's sort of packed in there like that. It seems to work in that way, don't you think?
Yeah, I do indeed. I mean, when we start talking about the units of three that makes a speech so powerfully aesthetic, so long as you've got 3 beats going together, they do tend to sort of stay in the mind more than anything else. You see, this is the ultimate test of eloquence. The ultimate test is, after somebody has given a speech and you've left the room and somebody comes up to you and says, what did they talk about? Then you've got to be able to remember it. And if it's a good speech, you will remember some fragments of it. And if it's a bad speech, you won't be able to remember anything. You'll say, oh, he just went on about I don't know what, and you'll forget it. And certainly there are elements in that Churchill speech which stick in the mind, like the bit you've mentioned, like the this was their finest hour, of course, which is the climax of the speech and the last word that's being said, and those last words are the ones that stay in the mind more than anything else. But yes, the memorability of a speech depends very much on that rhythm that you're identifying there.
David Crystal is with us. He's a scholar, a linguist. His book is called his new book, he's written a lot of books. His new book is called The Gift of Gab, How Eloquence Works. And we'll take a break. Be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West and KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about how eloquence works. The linguist David Crystal has been studying eloquence. He dissects the qualities of it, the shape of it, who's good at it, how you get it or teach it. And he's convinced eloquence doesn't have to be rare or exclusive. It's a talent, he says, that everyone can possess, does possess. His book is The Gift of Gab, How Eloquence Works. David Crystal, I wanted to get an opportunity to play a couple of pieces of tape that people would necessarily think, at least not off the bat. There's a cultural reference. We can go back to that here in a moment. But
we've got bats too, you know.
I know you do. That's right. Well, maybe we should mention that it's actually a great story. That you have to know your culture. You made a reference to a bat. But also I think it was an American professor said something about coming out of left field to an audience people in the Brits, and they had no idea what he was talking about.
No idea what you're talking about. I know now, I've boned up on it, but I didn't then. Hey, something just occurred to me, while you were taking that break. One of the features of eloquence is not overloading the attention span of your listener and giving the listeners every 5 minutes or so the chance to relax a second just by having a little pause or taking a drink of water or even having a cough or something of that kind. And then people sort of recharge their batteries. Suddenly occurred to me that the breaks that you guys put into your programs, I mean, of course, they're partly there for advertising purposes and public announcements and so on. But anybody who's tuned into this program and has got, as it were, 1 hour of listening to people talking about eloquence, those breaks are really important, aren't they? Because it gives people a chance to say, wow, that was interesting in the first 20 minutes. Now I'm ready for the next 20. It's interesting.
Yeah. And being aware of that is really important, and I think that's what the book is about. Let's talk about Bert Solaritza.
If I
pronounce that. It's this poetry contest in the Basque region.
Yeah.
Northern Spain. This is performance poetry. And you say in the book that it could be a definition of eloquence as a whole. I want to talk a little bit about and play a little bit from a performance that we found. You want to say something about this?
Well, it's the most extraordinary thing. Poetry contests, poetry battles, poetry competitions turn up all over the world. It isn't just a very kind of elitist, intellectual sort of exercise. These are ordinary people wanting to express themselves in a clever way as possible. And the challenges that they put, it's a bit like rapping, you know, the rap contests mm-hmm. that people have and the hip-hop contests that people have. And it's a bit like giving a challenge and upping the ante all the time. So I say to you, I want you, these are the rules for today. We're going to have a poem of four lines, and say the first and the third line have got to rhyme, and each line has got to be six syllables long, and the first line has got to have the word biscuit in it, and the third line has got to have the word sunshine in it. Go.
Yeah, right.
It's that sort of thing that Bert Solari is.
Yeah, well, here's a performer at a Basque competition. This is a clip, actually, we found from a short documentary about Bert Solari.
Oh, well done. Baina neretzat sua dugu berso gintza, bersoa balitza, sua den baldintza. Biz dezagun itza alaituz bizitza, hemen su horren bueltan.
So the prompt here, he was given the word fire. Those who may speak may understand what it's saying. It doesn't necessarily matter. I wanted people to hear the sense of the sort of rhythm. That's eloquence, right? I mean, that's rhythmic. That's a performance there.
Yeah, this is the other thing I forgot to mention earlier on. You know, a lot of the poetry competitions are not sort of singing at all. Although sometimes with rapping, the voice goes up and down and all over the place in a very sing-song sort of way. But yes, this is a sung piece of performance, all improvised. Mm-hmm. And the guy might have been given the cue only 10 seconds before,
you see.
He's got no time to prepare it other than the instinct and the ability to put it across. That's why it's such a powerful competition.
Let me talk about a few elements of all of this that you mentioned in the book. Three basic components here. You say to be eloquent, you have to figure out first, you have to have something to say. Hmm. You have to have an understanding of the needs and the expectation of the audience. And thirdly, lastly, you say you need to know the ways in which language allows us to say things in extraordinary ways. What do you mean by that last one?
Well, it's a bit like any art form, really. I mean, eloquence is an art form. You and I can paint or sing or anything, maybe a little bit. But we want to do something better. We've got to learn the tricks of the trade. We've got to learn the limitations of our voice or the limitations of our hands and things like this. And then we learn from others and we try to emulate them. We try to copy them and then make them become part of our own personal experience. And so the interesting thing is to analyze a lot of the famous speakers and see exactly how it is that they achieved the effect that they achieved. At what point in a political speech is everybody going to cheer and cheer and cheer? What was it that actually caused them to do that? And the same point applies if it's just a speech at a wedding, you know, and the guy is doing a very good job and he's talking about all the things to do with the wedding, and then he suddenly gets everybody laughing and clapping. What was it that enabled him to do that? And that's what I mean by doing a bit of analysis.
Fluency is important. Give me a sense of what you mean by fluency.
Fluency is the ability to speak at length without breaking down, essentially. But on the other hand, not too fluently, not too glib. You know, if you speak without any kind of naturalness, people will say, oh, he doesn't mean it, you know, or she doesn't mean it. Very, very glib. All words and no action is a comment that's sometimes made about politicians who are a little too fluent. And so what you need to do to be fluent is to be naturally fluent. And that means putting in things that you might think sometimes are a bit irrelevant, like pauses, for example, just like that. You know, putting the occasional one in, not too much, otherwise it'll destroy the effect. Or saying something like, you know, or you see, or I mean. And these little phrases are from everyday conversation, and the really good speaker drops the occasional one into the speech and makes it seem very, very naturally fluent.
You know, where the book, you talk about some of these rules or some of these techniques, but you say that there are times, and it seems like Martin Luther King's speech, this was in, of course, August of 1963, his dream speech, is an example of how there are rules to be broken. Say something about this, because I want to play a moment from this speech, too, and give us a sense of what we're hearing in what you hear when you hear the I Have a Dream speech, because he breaks some rules.
Yes, he does. The basic rule of eloquence is that you don't overload the person that's listening's attention so that they get, as it were, fed up with what you're saying. If you say, make a point, and then you make a second point, all right. Then you make a third point, fine. And normally 3 points like that are enough to keep everybody very, very happy and to remember what you're saying. What you don't normally do is make a fourth point, right, or a fifth point, or a sixth point. And what is amazing about the, well, various parts in the Luther King speech, but especially at the end, when he launches into "Let freedom ring." Well, you know, the first time people will have heard that, they'll have thought, yeah, let freedom ring. It's a powerful statement. Then he does it a second time, very powerful. And then a third time. And most people would have expected that to be it, you know. 3 times is enough. 3 strikes and you're out, as it were. But he goes on a fourth time and a fifth time and a sixth time. That's what I mean by breaking the rules. And he got away with it beautifully.
I still have a dream.
Yes.
It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream.
Yes.
I have a dream.
Mm-hmm.
That one day, this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners, will they be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood? I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children.
So what's interesting about this is he seems to be headed some way, and then when the let freedom ring comes at the end, it's almost like a completely different speech.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? I mean, the I Have a Dream sequence, he says that I have a dream 8 times.
Yeah.
You know, that is extraordinary by any standards. But did you notice also, just like in the Churchill speech, how some of these quite long sentences, you know, the I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, that goes on for about 30 words or more.
Yeah.
And yet he breaks it down into these easily memorable chunks. And did you notice also how he made the speech even if it was written down in advance, making it sound very natural by just dropping these pauses in every now and again. Mm-hmm. With the heat of, he doesn't say with the heat of injustice, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice. He says a state sweltering with the heat of injustice.
Yeah.
And that little pause, right? You know, it makes all the difference.
You know, there's a point you make in the book also about this, the importance of culture, the difference of culture. We were mentioning the, you know, bat and left field. But I wonder if you're hearing in the Martin Luther King delivery of that speech, it was an African-American crowd. And he does use the cadence. In some ways, it's not directly a call and response, but he does use the cadence of African-American churches. Is that important to understand in that speech?
Well, I think it is. I can't explain otherwise some of the way in which he breaks the rules that people who don't have that tradition would not understand. I mean, especially noticeable feature there was the way in which he ends a paragraph, as it were, that all men are created equal. I have a dream. And he goes straight on. He doesn't break the end of the paragraph and say, all men are created equal. Dee-dum, dee-dum, dee-dum. Now, I have a dream. You know, he builds up the next paragraph almost without pause from the preceding one. And that is something that is very typical of very powerful preachers in some types of denomination. You know, some of the great powerful sermons that I've heard from preachers in the south of the United States, and also actually very strong in Wales too, where that kind of speech style is traditionally powerful in some of the Protestant traditions that we have here. And it's just very noticeable, yeah.
David Crystal is with us. His book is The Gift of the Gab, How Eloquence Works. We'll take another break and be back in a moment. We'll give you a break, and then we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with scholar and linguist David Crystal. We're talking about his book, The Gift of the Gab, How Eloquence Works. Are people as eloquent today as they were in the past?
I think so, yeah. But a different kind of eloquence.
Right.
Certainly when you listen back to the radio speeches of, you know, 50 years ago, and you hear a cultured, controlled, almost unnaturalistic style of speaking, which is simply not the way it's done today. I mean, you do notice these things when you listen back to the archives. There have been changes.
There's a certain colloquial informality today in the way we speak. And, you know, I guess at first you figure, oh, that's going to be an obstacle to this kind of eloquence. But it doesn't necessarily matter. The importance of eloquence is that it's important for the context of the time, I guess.
Yes, I think so. The thing is that any eloquent speech, something that we remember long after it's been produced, you don't actually remember the colloquialism of it.
Mm-hmm.
The colloquialism is a kind of oil which enables the powerful bits of the speech to sort of slip naturally into your ear and into your brain and into your memory. And so what you remember actually is the structured parts of the speech, the aesthetically most powerful parts of the speech, the triples, the way in which people use groups of three and things of this kind to get their point across. Embedding this into a kind of natural context means that the speaker is, as it were, warming to the audience, and the audience is warming to the speaker. The thing when you listen back to all those early speeches of 50 years ago is that it's very difficult to warm to the speaker because they are almost keeping a formal distance from you, whereas the best speakers today reach out to talk like we do.
What do you hear in John F. Kennedy's inaugural speech, the Ask Not What You Can Do For Your Country, but, you know, what do you hear in that?
Well, I hear the somebody who is very much trying to build a rapport with listeners in a kind of very natural, contrived sort of manner. It's a speech where you do remember bits and pieces, isn't it? Even though it's all that time ago. Like the Obama victory speech is another one where you know, over here, I suppose it's the same with you. Everybody says it's the "Yes, we can" speech.
Right,
you know,
right.
Isn't that amazing that that phrase, which previously had been in the language for 1,000 years, suddenly became part of everybody's memory?
Yeah. I want to break down the victory speech from President Obama, because this is one that you pay some attention to in the book.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time on that one. I had to choose one speech to really go into it in detail. There wasn't room for more than one, so I chose that one.
It's interesting to see how there's a little appendix at the end of the book where you include the speech, and it's interesting you lay it out and you put everything in lowercase.
Mm. Well, that's right. There are no capital letters in the way you and I are talking now,
is it, right.
I mean, and actually no full stops and commas and semicolons or anything either. All we've got to play with are pauses, which you can mark with dashes and things like that. And the thing about a capital letter is that it draws attention to itself straight away when you see it written down. And if you're representing a speech on the page, you want to make sure that the important elements of the speech don't get obscured by mm-hmm. capital letters. And that's why I did it that way.
All right, let's play this right from the beginning of the speech.
Okay.
And this is this massive if clause. It has 41 words in it. And David Crystal, you say that really shouldn't have worked.
Absolutely. I remember watching it and turning to my wife and saying, yeah, he'll never do it. You can't start a speech off like that with such a long sentence coming up and get away with it. But he did.
If there is anyone out there who still doubts that America is a place where all things are possible, who still wonders if the dream of our founders is alive in our time, who still questions the power of our democracy, tonight is your answer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Three lovely if clauses and then a powerful ending, and the cheers started straight away.
Why did that speech work, do you think, so well? It's different. It has different components to it. I mean, it's interesting to see you break it down into clauses, but if you could boil it down, why did that speech work for you?
Well, you mean the beginning part that we just listened to?
No, the whole thing,
the thing as a whole.
Yeah.
Well, the thing as a whole works because he is adept, or at least his speechwriters are adept. Who knows, you know, where this speech comes from in a way. There'll be people listening who will perhaps know the answer to that question, how many people were involved in the writing of it. But whoever did it was very, very clever in that, in getting across long, sentences of considerable length, but allowing them to break down into these rhythm units. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you take that bit we've just heard, if there's anyone out there, you know, pause. Wow, now we're ready for something complex. Who still doubts? Pause. That America is a place? Pause. Where all things are possible? Pause. And so you get, although it's a long sentence, he's feeding us the chunks. Each chunk is, as it were, a self-contained chunk. And we process it and wait for the next bit. The grammar is telling us there's more to come. And then he structures it very cleverly into these three who clauses. Who still doubts? Who still wonders? Who still questions? You know, and this group of three is a characteristic of Obama, of all great speakers.
Yeah.
But he uses it over and over and over.
Well,
and I've just done it there, over and over and over.
Well, right. You say that that's the technique that seems to stand above the rest. It's called the rule of three.
The rule of three.
And I guess in all great speeches, they know how to use it. How does it work, and why does it work so much on us?
Well, there's something about three. I mean, think triangles. Think the pyramids. You know, there's something about three which makes for a sort of sense of completeness in a way that other things don't. And if I'm trying to persuade you to vote for me, Doug, and I say to you, you know, I was with you yesterday, so please vote for me. And you think, oh, right, okay, well, maybe. I was with you yesterday, and I'm with you today, so please vote for me. Well, okay. I was with you yesterday. I'm with you today, and I'll be with you tomorrow.
Yeah.
oh, now I'm going to vote for you, because that third one, with an appropriate climax, seems to round off the sequence into a kind of symbol of everything. The suggestion is not just yesterday, today and tomorrow, but forever. I don't actually have to say forever. It's implicit in the completeness of the rule of three. And that's what Obama does over and over, and all great speakers do.
We'll come back to hearing some of his triples in a moment. It's interesting you mentioned how Churchill would push the triples with fours, and it would work sometimes.
Yeah, but only by keeping them short.
Right.
You know, blood, toil, tears, and sweat.
Yeah.
You know, that works, but only because the four units are pretty short. And if you start doing something like Obama was doing and do four of them, you'll soon lose the listener.
Here's a moment of this President Obama's speech that where he gets highly personal, and it's interesting because what you've noticed here and you write about in the book is that there's more of the structure's looser here, the sentences are shorter here, the vocabulary is more private and down to earth. This is would you say something about that, because he sort of changes the style for a moment in this part.
Well, he does this two or three times in the course of the speech. We are talking about a pretty long speech. Mind you, it is a victory speech, so I guess you could get up there and read the telephone directory and people would cheer you. But at the same time, there are certain things you've got to say. There are certain elements of the content that have got to be there. And the cleverness of it is that you make each of these bits of content sound different from the one that's just happened and the one that's about to happen. And he does this beautifully in the middle when he's got to talk about praising his opponents, and he does it very cleverly at the end when he talks about the old lady, because there's another personal element there. So this up and down of style is a very important feature of the speech.
And I would not be standing here tonight without the unyielding support of my best friend for the last 16 years, the rock of our family, the love of my life, the nation's next First Lady, Michelle Obama. Sasha and Malia, I love you both more than you can imagine, and you have earned the new puppy that's coming with us to the White House.
Yeah, got to talk about the puppy and talk about the personal, and it's very different. And then you say there's this moment in the speech when President Obama sort of gets down to business. Let me play this moment, and I want to have you say something about that.
Okay.
But above all, I will never forget who this victory truly belongs to. It belongs to you. It belongs to you. I was never the likeliest candidate for this office. We didn't start with much money or many endorsements. Our campaign was not hatched in the halls of Washington. It began in the backyards of Des Moines, in the living rooms of Concord, and the front porches of Charleston. It was built by working men and women who dug into what little savings they had to give $5 and $10 and $20 to the cause. It grew strength from the young people who rejected the myth of their generation's apathy, who left their homes and their families for jobs that offered little pay and less sleep. It drew strength from the not-so-young people who braved the bitter cold and scorching heat to knock on doors of perfect strangers, and from the millions of Americans who volunteered and organized and proved that more than two centuries later, a government of the people, by the people, and for the people has not perished from the earth. This is your victory.
So you're hearing, so it's interesting, I'm hearing those triples, the backyards of Des Moines, the
aren't
living
you?
Rooms of Concord, the front porches of Charleston,
absolutely.
$5 and $10 and $20. I mean, those triples are so pronounced in there.
Absolutely, and especially of the people, by the people, and for the people. This is very clever, clever writing. And it's a good example, you know, if the man had said they had to give $5 for the cause, wouldn't have mean anything. $5 and $10 still doesn't mean anything, but $5 and $10 and $20 suddenly implies any number of dollars. You know? And that's the clever bit of it.
Let me play another moment of this. There's the kind of call and response thing going on, and this is where we get the yes, we can,
yes, we can
part of this. Do you want to say something about this before I play this little exchange with the crowd?
Well, it takes a while. It doesn't work straight away. If you want to interact with a crowd, you've got to teach them how to react to you. And the first time you do it, you're not going to get the reaction that you necessarily want. It actually doesn't become really successful until you've done it twice.
At a time when women's voices were silenced and their hopes dismissed, she lived to see them stand up and speak out and reach for the ballot. Yes, we can. When there was despair in the Dust Bowl and depression across the land, she saw a nation conquer fear itself with a new deal, new jobs, a new sense of common purpose. Yes, we can. When the bombs fell on our harbor and tyranny threatened the world, she was there to witness a generation rise to greatness and a democracy was saved. Yes, we can. She was there for the buses in Montgomery.
And so on and so on. And he teaches the crowd, and then they're there at the end.
Absolutely. The first time, did you notice? Did everybody notice that the crowd is silent?
Yeah.
They have no idea that Yes We Can is going to be a big thing. And then the second time, the crowd starts to shout. And the third time, they're really shouting. And of course, by the time he's done it, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 times, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
He's home and dry.
He is. Well, here's the big finish. And this last sequence, as you mentioned in the book, begins with this burst of triples, linguistic fire. Fireworks displays. How you put it.
Yes.
This is our moment. This is our time to put our people back to work and open doors of opportunity for our kids, to restore prosperity and promote the cause of peace, to reclaim the American dream and reaffirm that fundamental truth that out of many we are one, that while we breathe, we hope, and where we are met with cynicism and doubt and those who tell us that we can't, we will respond with that timeless creed that sums up the spirit of a people. Yes, we can. Thank you. God bless you. And may God bless the United States of America.
It's a win.
It's David Crystal. His book is The Gift of the Gab, How Eloquence Works. He joined us from his home studio in Wales. David Crystal, thank you very much for the time.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks, Dave.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.